The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up,
the fact that we understand nature so well that when we turn on the LHC for the first time and we see the Z boson and it's where it should be, still impresses me. I still get goosebumps even talking about it now.
Physicist and friend of Science Weekly, John Butterworth, joins us to discuss his book Smashing Physics, an insider's view on the extraordinary experiment in particle physics that is the Large Hadron Collider. And the pod is full of big thinkers this week as Nishad Karim reports from a London symposium on the origins of life. We hear from two researchers, Dr. Zita Martins and Dr. Dominic Papineau, on why the answer may be tantalisingly close. And finally, here in the UK, we may be experiencing the hottest summer on record. I'll be discussing the hard data on this scorcher with The Guardian's Carl Matheson from the Environment Desk. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. We kick off this week with the big one. How did life in our universe begin? Not to shy away from difficult topics, I'm joined by Guardian intern and physicist Nishad Karim. Nishad, University College London ran a symposium on this topic last week. You went along to hear some of the talks. How optimistic was this conference on beginning to answer such an existential conundrum?
Pretty optimistic. It's always great to get a whole load of scientists in a room who are looking at similar issues, and just to get collaboration and free thought amongst them is always a great idea. Whether they're closer is a different question. I think they might have been able to at least iron out some problems they had with each other's ideas, and that always helps.
So what sort of scientists turn up to these sorts of events?
Well, this particular event, The Origins of Life, is very far-reaching, and so it had everyone from physicists, cosmologists, biologists, chemists, earth scientists, all the ologists.
So were there a good bunch of theories that a lot of scientists generally agree on? Are people there talking about life in the universe beginning on Earth, or life coming from other places and being seeded other places? What sort of theories are people looking at?
Well, there are loads of different theories out there, depending on who you ask. At that particular symposium, a lot of the people believe that life didn't necessarily start off at Earth, or rather the building blocks that initially kicked off life on Earth didn't originate from here, but rather came through other channels, meteorites, comets, etc. But some of the people were looking at simply life starting its beginnings here back on Mother Earth.
I suppose one of the intriguing things is that if you have comets and asteroids carrying around some of these precursors to life, some of the building blocks, the chemicals, basic chemicals you need to, it's almost like feedstocks for life to begin whenever they hit something, then the idea is, well, you know, if those things arrived on Earth and conditions were right here, you know, could those similar comets, similar asteroids have ferried that that vital kind of initial material out to other places where conditions at some other time or maybe around the same time were equally favourable to life kicking off.
Indeed. Actually, for my master's, I looked at Martian meteorites and such, and meteorites are one of the strong candidates to be the origins for life on this planet, and actually maybe even possibly other planets in the whole universe. Meteorites in particular contain proteins, which is an odd thing because you don't normally consider that to be with a rock. They also contain things like carbon and alcohol, which help in the formation of life. So it's a big candidate. Alternatively, it could also be that meteorites, which were initially pushed off the Earth when it was a very young body, could have actually been transported to other planets, and Earth could actually be a reason why other planets also have life.
Couldn't the violence of these impacts destroy the very chemicals you need later on to build, you know, your first basic bits of life?
Well, this is the interesting thing with meteorites. When they actually land on Earth, meteorites, whenever they go through the Earth's atmosphere, they heat up and they become this fireball. Only a few of them make it through. The few that do land are called meteorites. Otherwise, they're just meteoroids. However, the one thing that really is brilliant about them is that the inside survives. It's actually the first, it's less than a millimeter of the actual crust is damaged. the rest of it inside is as if it had it's really cold inside is the only way to explain it. If you cut a meteorite as soon as it landed, it'll be really cold inside. It wouldn't be warm at all.
So you spoke to Zita Martins from Imperial College here in London, and she was talking about her own work actually on analysing meteorites for these kinds of organic materials.
Yes, she does similar work to what I was just saying that I did for my masters. Basically, she looks at meteorites, but she looks at it for them in a more biological way. So she cuts these rocks up into small little bits and then analyzes the organic compounds within. And from that, she sees whether there are life signatures that we have here on Earth and compares them to see whether they can possibly be the building blocks required for life to start.
Well, again, as I mentioned, nobody actually knows how the origin of life started here on the Earth. So there are many theories and experimental work. In my case, I support an exogenous delivery of the building blocks of life. I'm not talking about life itself. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the building blocks of life.
Sorry, what do you mean by exogenous?
Exogenous means that the organic molecules that are fundamental for life came from side of the Earth, and they were delivered by comets, asteroids, meteorites, etc. So I support that. And why? Well, because I analyze actually extraterrestrial samples. I analyze meteorite samples. And actually we know that meteorite samples are very, very rich in the building blocks of life. And there are different techniques that we can use to actually determine that those organic molecules are extraterrestrial and they're not simple terrestrial contamination from our hands. So I like that. I like to analyze meteorite samples. It's something that I'm happy every time I go to the lab and I analyze meteorite samples. There are other people's, and the symposium we're having here today at UCL actually shows different theories, and they're all correct. I mean, we just have to collaborate and try to see if we manage to answer the big, big question, how did life originate?
And where do you see the work going in the future?
Oh, there are different paths. There are people really studying synthetic biology and whether you can recreate artificial life. That's one path. And then the other one, which is also very, very strong, is to develop lots of space missions and try to see whether the origin of life started somewhere else. So we're hearing a lot about missions to Mars. There are lots of planned missions also to the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. So, you know, there are lots of, I think space missions are also exciting, and there are lots of things going on in that sense.
Nishad, Zita mentions there this idea of almost kind of trying to create artificial life as a proof of some of the mechanisms that might have done it in the first place. How far can you go with that? What sort of things can you do?
Well, as I've mentioned that, and Zita has mentioned, there are essential building blocks in some of these meteorites and comets. And what some researchers are doing is putting these components together in a lab and seeing if they can be pushed together to see if life could sort of almost spontaneously start. Now, it's not quite as simple as that, but if they can get that going, then that would be a fundamental question answered, because no one knows how particles went from being components of building blocks to actually starting off life.
And by building blocks, are you talking about the chemical precursors of amino acids, things like that? So fairly complex organics themselves already.
Yes, but also in these meteorites and comets, fairly complex amino acids were already found. They're frequently found, in fact. So to some extent, some of that hard work's already been done.
It all sounds like it's getting a bit Frankenstein, that you're going to get all these chemicals together, put them in a sort of primordial soup, and then presumably zap it with electricity to simulate an early Earth lightning storm or something. I mean, what sort of things are we going to see crawling out of the Petri dishes?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. And to be honest, I have no idea, but it would be interesting to see if they're green or not, at the very least.
Nishad, you also spoke to Dominic Papineau, who's at UCL's Nanotech Centre. What's he got to do with this idea of the origins of life? What's he working on?
Well, interestingly enough, he actually looks at rocks from the Earth. So you had Zeta looking at meteorites and comets from outer space, but he focuses on Earth. And the rocks that he in particularly focuses on are ones that possibly have carbon inside of them. That is very different from looking at comets, but what he's doing is looking for life signs in the early, not universe, but early solar system, and more particularly on this planet. He's from the Nano Center, as you mentioned, and that's because what he does is he cuts up these rocks, again, similar to Zeta, but he looks at them in a completely different way. He analyzes the formation of the composites inside of these rock samples by viewing them under very, very, very powerful microscopes, such as scanning electron microscopes. And from that, you can find out an awful lot of information on what they're made of and signatures, again, for life.
Well, today I presented a summary of what we think we know about the early Earth, and especially the evidence for life on the early Earth. Mm-hmm. So it's a highly controversial and debated field of science, probably because it is important and people care about this and would like to have answers. People are curious to know where we come from and and how we can recognize life, because it's really the path to pave towards trying to find life on other planetary surfaces like Mars, for instance.
So. And what about you? What do you specifically work in? What field exactly? Because you're looking at early life, but what are you arguing particularly?
So at the London Centre for Nanotechnology, I have a wide suite of instruments that I use for doing correlated microanalyses. So correlated microanalyses is this approach in science that today is possible, and basically 10 years ago was not even in scientists' fantasies. And today what we can do is use all these techniques, these microanalytical techniques that give visual chemical information or visual geochemical information on the nature of microscopic object, and it's done in situ in the petrographic context of a rock. So we can microfabricate the target and then investigate it with photons and ions and electrons in a way that gives us a very good idea of the nature of the object that we're looking at. I'm particularly interested, of course, in the evidence for early life in terms of the carbonaceous material. We are all made of carbon. And so are all the microbes and the flies and the trees. And this carbonaceous material finds itself in rocks and gets metamorphosed and transformed. So it's not the same as it used to be. And really, using these correlated microanalyses on the same object, on a microscopic object, allows us to determine in situ all the chemical composition, all the chemical parameters that are important for distinguishing life from non-life signatures.
Mm-hmm. And why is this important?
Well, it's important because it tells us about when life originated on Earth. It tells us about the nature of the earliest microorganisms. It tells us about ourselves, where we come from, and also ultimately about where we are going. Mm-hmm. Because the most important question in science, not only in my opinion, but I think in the opinion of a lot of people out there, and the general public, I mean, is whether or not we are alone in the universe. Mm-hmm. And how are we going to find this out? Well, we can sit and wait and listen for, you know, extraterrestrial intelligence signals from radio or podcasts or whatever the equivalent that they have. Or we can go in a directed search and bring back samples from Mars, or send a robot there and do these analyses that will tell us, well, although are all those signatures that we're seeing in these Martian samples similar in one way or another to the signatures of life on the earliest Earth? Basically, if there is life somewhere on Mars today, there will be a long history of it also in the Martian rock record.
Was there anyone else at the symposium that caught your attention?
There was Professor Diego Francesco, who's a cosmologist, and he gave this amazing talk on the timeline of life from the Big Bang. Well, we weren't quite around at the Big Bang, but from that moment all the way till now, the present. And what was incredibly interesting was that he made a sort of washing line timeline. So it's basically a string across the lecture theatre that we were seated in. And on that string, he hung up various photos showing significant points in the last 13.8 billion years of the universe. And if you imagine that this string is maybe 8 meters across, the existence of humans on the planet Earth was the width of a single piece of paper.
It's about 200,000 years, I suppose. Yeah. It's not going to be wildly significant on that, isn't it? It puts it all in perspective.
It does indeed.
Nishad, thanks for coming in for that.
It's been a pleasure.
As we record this podcast, the temperature outside has reached 29 degrees Celsius, or 84.2 degrees Fahrenheit, which is actually quite toasty for us rain-sodden Brits. But what is happening on land is nothing compared to what's happening in the oceans. Carl Matheson is a writer on the environment and wildlife and a freelancer here at The Guardian. He manned our live blog dedicated to the question, will 2014 shape up to be the hottest year on record? Carl, why do we think it might be the hottest year on record?
Thanks, Ian. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the US this week released some figures for June, which is the global surface temperature. And this June was the hottest June ever globally. This was due in a large part to the oceans heating up quite markedly. That comes off the back of their May results, which also showed that May was the hottest May ever. So this year has already shown quite a few of these results. Even the early half of the year, where you had the polar vortex in the US, was still reasonably hot, except for February, right in the middle of that polar vortex. So we've seen the first 6 months of this year has been the fourth hottest year on record.
So this isn't about the weather. This isn't about temperatures in specific countries and specific regions of countries. This is about averaging out the global surface temperature over the whole world, right?
That's right, yeah. And that's not to say that there haven't been regional records tumbling. I think especially New Zealand saw an enormous heat wave through June that broke all sorts of records. So and NOAA did say that every single continent on Earth except Antarctica experienced some kind of regional record as well. So those have been tumbling, but the really big picture is the one that they're concerned with, because that's what's telling us about climate change and global warming.
Why should there be something going on specifically with the oceans? Why would it be that the oceans will warm up in particular? When you think about the world, you'd imagine it would all kind of warm up at the same rate.
Well, it's obviously a really complex system, and we talked to a lot of climate scientists yesterday about what's going on, and specifically in the oceans. And they said that partly what we're seeing is the effect of we're changing from a La Nina cycle into an El Nino cycle, and that means it really changes the ocean temperature in the Pacific. Right now, the oceans in the eastern Pacific Ocean, the central Pacific Ocean, are now showing real signs that they're heating up quite a lot, and that's what happens when you get these El Nino cycles.
What are the La Nina, El Nino cycles?
Well, El Nino and La Nina are weather climate phenomenons that are driven by the Pacific Ocean currents. Generally, what we see in an El Nino cycle is an upwelling of really warm water in the eastern Pacific. It then sort of passes over and crosses over through the Pacific into the central Pacific, and it brings with it much wetter, warmer conditions in a lot of places. It also brings droughts in places like India and Australia. So it has an enormous effect on the weather system. The reverse kind of happens in a La Nina year, and we see these cycles going on over about every 5 to 10 years. Sometimes it's a shorter cycle, so we're just shifting gears right now.
So what seems to be different this year, though, in particular, to make it an outstanding year?
Because I think what we're seeing is the baselines are shifting. So we haven't had many El Nino cycles over the past, say, 15 to 20 years. We've only really seen, I think, three El Nino cycles. We've been predominantly in a La Nina period. In that time, what we've also seen is the global temperature being increased generally by greenhouse gas emissions. And so we've got this increasing baseline of temperature, which is really probably to do with what we're seeing generally in this first half of this year, which hasn't been influenced by El Nino. Now that we're coming into that period and seeing global ocean temperatures heating up, scientists think that the next half of this year, we're likely, if we go into an El Nino period, to see a really, really hot year occur. People can have a look at the blog. It's on the Eco Audit on theguardian.com/environment. There's some really interesting things on there about the three hottest years on record that we've seen, which were 2010, 2005, 1998, and comparing that to what's already happened this year. And what's really interesting about those years is that they were years where we saw El Nino events happening in the year before. So where we're at now, we're actually seeing us coming out of a relatively cool year as far as, you know, being in a La Nina event. We've had temperatures slightly suppressed, basically, and yet we're still on the fourth hottest year on record. So there's an amazing graph on the blog that shows where we're at compared to those years, and we're really running neck and neck as far as the hottest year. Even without the El Nino. And we're starting to see now scientists say that they're almost certain we're going to see an El Nino of some sort, probably not a huge one, but a moderate one coming into effect towards the end of the year. That will have the effect of bumping temperatures up. All we need to do at the moment is basically kind of keep on level pegging to have the hottest year ever. So if temperatures go up a little bit, then it's likely, they think, maybe that we'll see the hottest year on record. Scientists also said that 2015 they're really looking towards, because if El Nino really kicks in, then 2015 will be exceptionally hot, they think.
A huge thanks to Carl Matheson there. You can follow Carl on Twitter at Carl Matheson. That's at and then KARLMATHIESEN. Or check out his blog, carljourneylist.wordpress.com, for no other reason than to see Carl holding a very large rat of sorts.
I know, that's a wombat, Ian.
It's a wombat.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
John Butterworth is one of the UK's leading experimental physicists and a member of the 3,000-strong ATLAS team at CERN, the European Particle Physics Lab near Geneva. He's just published Smashing Physics, the first real insider account of life working on the Large Hadron Collider and being part of that team that discovered the Higgs boson. John came into Guardian HQ to discuss the roller coaster that is working on the world's largest scientific experiment.
It's a very strange question to answer, what's it like at CERN, because in some ways it's just like anywhere else. It's a bunch of fairly run-down huts with corridors in need of a bit of paint and a Wi-Fi signal that's variable, and people who are having meetings too often and arguing with each other over coffee. On the other hand, underlying it all is the fact that you've got this most remarkable enterprise going on underneath. You've got the Large Hadron Collider passing below your feet. The whole raison d'etre of the lab is something quite remarkable. And you do occasionally have to kind of slap yourself and think, what's this all about? Because like any other job, it becomes routine. I mean, one of the reasons that I wrote the book was to try and sort of demystify it, because it seems like something so other. And in a way that it is, because that is so special, what this trying to understand. The fact that whole thing is there just to try and understand better how the universe works, that is remarkable. I wouldn't underplay that On the other hand, it's just done by people. You know, there's nothing terribly special about the people there. We're just people doing a job in the end. The job is special. And it's trying to connect that and say, you know, this is something remarkable that's been achieved. But it's been achieved by normal people. It's not been achieved by some master race or some bunch of weirdos. It's just a bunch of people doing jobs.
But the lab was set up, wasn't it, to be a kind of focal point, to have a kind of... huge mass of people in Europe, of scientists in Europe, to retain scientists in Europe after the
60th anniversary this year. It was set up in 1954, and it was really set up to try and help rebuild European science after the war, and explicitly non-military and explicitly apolitical, and not primarily intended for economic benefit, although clearly everyone had in the back of their mind that having an excellent science centre in the middle of Europe won't do the economy any harm, kind of thing.
Coming back to what it's like at the lab there, you have something like 20 members, probably more than that since I last looked. You have a lot of people from a lot of countries coming to the same lab. All of them, thousands of them, all of them are physicists or related. Does it not get a bit odd at times that I wonder what that mix
what are
of people... I'm wondering what that means. You have this incredible cultural diversity, but they're all really hardcore geeks.
Yeah.
Does anything sort of... strange happen?
True. I mean, actually, you know, bizarrely, the number of people employed by CERN, physicists are a tiny minority. Most of them are actually engineers and of various types of software.
But
engineers.
Can you just go and play football without someone saying, well, actually, if we work out the angles of this or if the trajectory of that ball's all wrong, how did that happen?
Yeah, you can just go and play football like that. Even physicists have days off. I think apart from the physics discussions, which go on all the time, probably the single most common trait is the nerdiness about computing, to be honest, and the intense discussions about software and operating systems and stuff like that, which physicists will talk about even when they're not, even on their day off, kind of thing.
Why do you think it is, though, that the Large Hadron Collider and the Higgs boson came to kind of be what CERN was all about to really kind of capture the public imagination?
It's a difficult one because actually looking back at it, certainly the experiments in the 80s with the W and the Z boson could easily have, they're just from a physics point of view just as exciting, and also the Large Electron Positron Collider, which is exactly as big as the LHC because it's in the same tunnel. It's not obvious to me why there wasn't the same level of interest. One factor that is definitely true is that the culture of in science changed. So I think people were much more ready to, we, the physicists, were much more ready to actually try and engage people earlier and more openly than in the past, I think.
Do you think that's because you'd have pressure on sort of funding, or you'd had some scrapes with government, you know, the LHC involvement, UK's involvement with the LHC was dicey at times?
Yeah.
Was it something there that mobilised you lot to say, look, we've got to start actually talking about this stuff?
I guess so. It's a little bit before my time, but I was doing my PhD at the end of the 80s, and certainly the message was going out then that that talking to the public and politicians and our fellow scientists about what we were doing was actually a good thing to be doing. And it's not obvious that that message went out to previous generations of PhD students. Often, you know, public engagement can be seen like a distraction. You're not a serious scientist. How come you've got time to do that kind of thing?
And pretty frowned on by your colleagues sometimes in the past, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's still the case at some level. There's still elements of that, but I think there's been a cultural shift there. It was probably partly to do that, you know, famously the Thatcher government, well, they weren't particularly keen on big government projects. They weren't particularly keen on Europe. And there was a moment where they seriously considered pulling out of CERN. And actually, to her credit, Thatcher stayed in. Maybe good thing she had a science degree. But there was a scare then. There was clearly a discussion then. And I think that probably had an influence. Of course, this is all very UK-focused, but I think actually the UK did lead the public engagement bit of CERN, actually. I think there was a key moment when... James Gillies, who's the director of communication there, they agreed to let the media into the control room. So Andrew Marr and Brian Cox went for the day with BBC Radio 4. And that really I think a lot of media organisations went, well, if the BBC are going, then, you know, and not just in Britain, I mean, the European organisations as well. So I think that gave it a big impetus. And that was quite brave. I mean, it went wrong 9 days later. It could have gone wrong on the day. It could have been hugely embarrassing. A lot of the science and scientists and management at CERN So, you know, why on earth are we doing this? We've got a serious job to do here. The last thing we want is people poking cameras in our faces. But I think actually that was the right decision. I mean, actually one of the themes in the book as well is that being open, when you're open with the media or with the public, you lose control and you've just got to accept that. You can't manage the news anymore. You've just got to tell people what you're doing. But then the bottom line is we've nearly got nothing to hide. I mean, okay, it was terrible when the machine broke after 9 days. It was really embarrassing, and it was very sad, especially for the students who were just starting to, you know, wanted the data that year. But on the other hand, that's science. You know, we were on the cutting edge of engineering. We kept saying we were. Well, you know, it wasn't stage managed. It could go wrong. I mean, you know, it's not like anyone was hurt or anything, but it was hugely embarrassing. And I think you can't have it both ways, really. If you want people to be excited and interested in what you're doing, you've got to be open and honest with them. You can't kind of just cherry pick the nice bits and feed them that. And I think you guys in the media, we've been lucky because it's been a long story. We haven't just suddenly popped up and said, yes, we've cured cancer, or eureka, this is what we thought of today. The build-up itself has been a story, and the caveats and consequences afterwards have also been still a story, because it's been going on a long time. And the scale of it means that it's been of interest to people. So I hope we've managed to use that opportunity to actually explain, although the LHC is unique in scale, the whole business of having a long preparation and a dodgy start and unclear consequences and having to wait for more data, that's very typical of any type of science, right? I mean, maybe a very different scale. It may just be in your cellar or on your lab if it's a different kind of science. But it's still the same kind of thing. And I think we've managed to reflect that rather than just appearing one day with a Higgs boson to tell everyone about it and then going away again. We've actually seen the build-up and seen the digesting of the information afterwards as well.
There was one thing that I think the media was really to blame for and that was around the whole end of the world scenarios, that the LHC, as soon as you switch on, you're going to devour Geneva and the Earth is going to collapse in a sort of into a some sort of ball of strange matter and things like this. And it, you know, it wasn't helped that sort of similar concerns were raised in Martin Rees's book, you know, Our Final Century. But I remember being there for Big Bang Day, the switch on of the LHC the first time around in 2008, and being writing stories next to a guy who was doing a piece to camera for TV, going on about, we're about to see if the world will end. And the morning I turned up at CERN, there was no one outside with placards saying, please don't end the world. There was no one chained to the railings, no one trying to get into the tunnel. It was such a sort of a crazy thing where the media would keep repeating comments by a handful of people, mostly profoundly unqualified to talk about that kind of stuff. But one thing it may have done was give scientists a chance to talk about some tricky physics around why you wouldn't create black holes, why if you did create black holes, it might be evidence of extra dimensions, why those black holes might then evaporate incredibly quickly. And so there was that kind of opportunity there, but it did seem to me that it was probably the last thing researchers there needed to be spending their time on, when you had a heck of a lot of other stuff going on.
And I mean, that's the thing about you lose control when you open up, right? In the end, you have to meet people wherever they are. And if that's where they are, you have to talk about that.
In the run-up to Big Bang Day, you know how you're going to search for this particle. And I know there are other things that you're searching for as well with the LHC.
Yeah.
The media all pile down for the Big Bang Day. Everyone has this incredible, very optimistic and lovely, I think, launch of the LHC. A lot of interest behind it, a lot of positivity around it, and it must have been wonderful. Maybe perhaps slightly nerve-wracking for the scientists and engineers involved. But then within 2 weeks, that the machine's shut down.
Yeah.
And how did you find out what had happened? What were you? Take us through it.
I was sitting at my desk at UCL and watching the status display of the LHC in the back, through the corner
so
of one eye.
So you can kind of watch a screen that they tells had you online, how the beams are going?
Yeah, they had an online display. And the bit I could see, at least, when something went wrong, it wasn't obvious how serious it was. It was like, oh, that's a bit of a shame. Because they were getting very close to first collisions, right? We hadn't actually collided any.
So they were circulating beams around, but they hadn't sort of crossed their paths.
That's right. And they hadn't actually gone up to full energy because... Right. So the whole thing is in octants, and you The key thing actually is the power of the bending magnets. So it's just Newton's law, right? These beams want to go in a straight line unless you act on them with a force. And it's that force which is the limiting factor on the energy, because they're so high momentum that bending them around the very shallow curve of the 27-kilometer tunnel requires an enormous amount of force.
Mm.
So they'd had all eight of the octants of the LHC were all cool, and they'd all been gone up to some amount of energy, and that's when it was circulated on the Big Bang Day, and it circulated in all directions and stored beams. But they hadn't taken up to full energy, and because that meant taking the magnets up to full current.
Mm.
And they'd done seven of the eight octants up to full current.
So these big superconductor magnets that you call down to steer the beam around the tunnel. Yeah.
And this was the last octant that hadn't been up to full current. And when they put it up to full current, there was a failure in one of the joins and it destroyed it, basically.
So you got a short circuit.
It was a spark, actually. It was these are superconducting. So and they need to be, because there's such a huge current going through. As soon as there's a resistance, it will dissipate heat. It will dissipate power. And the amount of power is huge, enough to melt the thing. So you need to keep them cool. You need to have no resistance. And there's all kinds of protection built in there that if a bit of resistance, called a quench, if there's a bit of resistance develops, you're supposed to dump the current immediately, safely, and all the magnets can do that.
Right.
But unfortunately, the joins between the magnets couldn't. And one of those failed and got vaporized because of the enormous current flowing through it. And then that would have already been bad. But then the really disastrous thing was that the current didn't get cut off quick enough, and there was a spark jumped the gap between across this where this connector had been, and that spark melted a hole in the liquid helium containment vessel, which, and then the liquid helium became gaseous helium very quickly, which is a big, you know, these 40 ton magnets were ripped out of their concrete they bolted to the floor, you know, in the concrete floor of the tunnel. They were just ripped out of it and moved, such an enormous force. So that was a big mess.
Yeah. What did you see on the screen?
I didn't see anything.
Do you just have lines that just go flat, or does the data stop changing, or what?
I've seen afterwards, you know, the whole thing just went red, and then they lost all the sensors on one of the octants, you know. But I didn't get to see that at the time. That was just in the control room. But yeah, it was pretty obvious that something pretty catastrophic had happened. In fact, I think they lost most of the sensors, so they didn't really have time to. It was just like we'd lost communication.
You told the world, CERN told the world in July 2012 that you'd got the particle on the 4th of July. Take us through when you first knew. What was, because I guess you get an early look, even a feeling in your stomach. Well, take us through that.
Yeah, I mean, so when I started working on the LHC, I didn't think the Higgs was there, right? My gut feeling was this is a bit of a wild goose chase, but I felt the question was important enough that we had to have an answer to the question. But I thought the answer would probably be no. Okay, that's just me. I think most physicists thought it was there. I think I was just being a bit perverse. But it's not a bad mindset with which to approach it. But I remember in December 2011, actually, so not that long before, in fact, there was some hints that we had something like 2 or 3 sigma. And at that point, when I saw that the other experiment, CMS, had something similar-ish, it was too early to be sure, but at that point I started believing the statistics. And the statistics were telling, it's probably there. You know, there's 60-70% chance it's there. And I thought, at that point, my gut feeling was with the statistics. Before that, when we were seeing limits and fluctuations and things had come and gone and that, I just thought, this is all consistent with it being nonsense. But when, in that December, then I started thinking there probably was something there. Still only probable, I didn't know for sure. And then we started taking data again in early 2012, and I remember a collaboration meeting then in, I think, spring 2012, so not that long before, right, where we saw the first new data set. So we had the old data set that had this hint of a Higgs in it, and then we saw completely fresh data, complete repeat of the experiment, different beam energies actually as well, so very independent. And there was a hint there as well. And I thought, well, okay, this is it. It's there. That's real. That was the moment I was convinced it was real.
Are you so close to it that it's like, okay, yeah, it's there? Or is it more, emotive for you? I mean, I wonder if you see it, something coming gradually, you'd imagine maybe you sort of a bit more, you have more time to get used to the
I'm naive news. Enough that even when we saw the Z boson and things that we already knew, when we turned on the LHC, we were doing a completely new experiment, different beam energies and everything. I have an enormous respect for experimental results. And the fact that these esoteric things really appear in data still amazes me sometimes, because it all sounds a bit nuts, all this kind of these quantum, fundamental quantum particles that are doing X, Y, Z. And the fact that we understand nature so well that when we turn on the LHC for the first time and we see the Z boson and it's where it should be, still impresses me. You know? Yeah. So even more so when there's a completely new particle like the Higgs, which is not only a new particle, but it's a new kind of particle, tells us something so fundamental about the way the universe works. I still get goosebumps even talking about it now.
John, the LHC isn't going to go on forever. What happens to CERN when there is another big collider, the next generation collider, maybe in Japan or wherever? Mm-hmm. What happens at CERN? And is it something that needs to be preserved as this center for keeping a lot of scientific expertise in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're at the stage of preservation yet. I think the LHC will run probably for at least another 20 years or so doing great science. So that, you know, there is now a big discussion going on all around the world in which CERN and Europe is a major player as to what we do want to do next. There's a big impetus actually to diversify a little bit. I mean, a lot of the field was concentrated, and a lot of the resources were concentrated on the LHC. Maybe we don't want to be quite so concentrated. Maybe there isn't such a one machine that we absolutely must have next. But maybe there is, and to some extent, it would depend what we find when we turn on again at higher energy. I think there's very few places in the world that have that. The capability that CERN has, and the discussion is kind of regional. I mean, there are serious discussions in Japan and also in China about major facilities in the Far East. Clearly, the Americans have got, Fermilab is a major resource. It contributes to the LHC as well, actually, as do the Japanese. But they want to have their own facilities as well, and there are plans for a major neutrino beam facility there, for instance, which Europeans want to be involved in, and then. People are talking about very high energy electron positron or colliders or very high energy proton machines. There's a picture, you can find a map on the web now of a possible tunnel 100 kilometers long around Geneva. And I mean, really around Geneva. If you know the area, goes, the Salève is in the middle of it. It's a tunnel, it goes under the lake, it goes, surrounds it, which you could go, you could get another similar factor of increase in energy that we got by building the LHC. If the science case is there, if you think that's a worthwhile thing to do. And it's kind of fun at the moment to be thinking about all these things and saying what technologies would need to be developed, what science would you do with it, is it really worthwhile, can we do it cheaper by being cleverer, all those kind of questions all being asked. And, we won't have more than one of them in the world, so can we distribute these around the world? And, European scientists want to do neutrino physics, but it probably won't happen at CERN. So can we do reciprocal agreements where we, either in Japan or in the States, make a major contribution there and they make a major contribution to whatever happens at CERN? So it's kind of interesting. We've had a planning blight when we didn't, when the LHC had to work and we had to know whether or not there was a Higgs. I think that what we've learned already from the LHC and what we'll learn when we turn it on and what we've learned recently from neutrino experiments all are having a big impact on the way we think of particle physics and the universe, as are things like astrophysical observations. So it's kind of fun. We need to get serious about thinking about these things now, but there's no urgency to start digging right now, because the LHC will be doing great science for a while, and as will these neutrino experiments. So
there you go. John Butterworth, thanks so much for joining us on Science Weekly.
It's a pleasure.
A massive thanks to John Butterworth, and Smashing Physics is out in all good on and offline bookshops now, also available as an audiobook for those long journeys. Remember, for breaking science news night and day, just go to theguardian.com/science. That's all we have for you this week. Thanks for listening, and remember to recommend us to your friends. But from me, Ian Sample, and producer Jason Phipps, it's bye-bye for now.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.